Welcome to the Bringing Rural Back podcast, where we help you live a more prepared and sustainable life today so that you can have a better tomorrow no matter what. And I actually mean that. Today is episode number 24, and I am your host, Greg Carter. In today's episode, we have our first ever full rural roundtable episode. So if you have questions, you'd like to get them into some of these experts. I think right now we have three, maybe four on deck. Be sure and send us your questions to theruraleconomist@gmail.com, and we'll get it on an upcoming episode, either standalone or like this, a full rural roundtable episode. So let's get into it. The way that we're going to start is we're going to do like a mini interview and the first question with one of the roundtable members, Stacy Lynn Harris. So I hope you enjoy it. And on today's show, we have a special guest, one of the members of the Rural Roundtable and fellow Alabamian, Stacy Lynn. Welcome to the Bringing Rural Back podcast. How are you today?
Thank you. I am so glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. Now, you run gameandgarden.com.
Yes.
And on that site, you talk a heck of a lot about cooking.
I do. That's a very big topic to me.
And see, I don't really talk a whole lot about cooking. I mean, I think since my inception of my blog and podcast, I think I've released like a sum total of 5 recipes.
Well, you know, I mean, different people do different things, but it all comes from what you're doing. I mean, you can't cook without food, and you're talking about, you know, growing it, and you're talking all about shelters, and I mean, you got to have food, shelter, and water. And
right.
So, you know, you focus more on the making of it.
Yeah,
you know,
I do focus more on infrastructure, I guess.
Tell
us a little bit about yourself. I know that at one time you were an attorney.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I began to have children, and I had 7 kids. And so as I continued to have them, I wanted to stay at home, so I did. And then my husband is a big hunter, so I wrote a cookbook, and it had wild game in it because I felt like people – you know, that were in my position as a wife of a hunter, that it's kind of frustrating because they bring this meat home that you don't know what to do with. And so it's easier for you just to go to the grocery store and get what they have there because you know it's going to taste pretty good. They pump it full of stuff or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how to cook it because you're used to it. So I wanted to write for people that did not know what to do with these really lean cuts of meat. So I wrote a book, and then about 6 months or so after the release of the book, I had a production company and publishing company come to me and ask me to write another one. So I wrote another one on sustainability, and I got it, and they want to do a DVD on cooking venison. And so that's how it began.
Okay. So you kind of, were you dragged into it kicking and screaming, or did you just happily go into the wild game cooking?
No. You know, I had a real problem because my husband loved to hunt. I'm talking about every day, every morning, every afternoon. And we almost didn't get married because of that. And he kind of backed off of it, and I kind of acted like I didn't care, but I really still did. And so it was hard for about probably the first 2 years of our marriage. And finally one day I felt like, you know, I'm just bucking him all the time on this. I'm just going to bend with him, and I'm going to learn to love what he does. And so as soon as I did that, you know, this just took off, and it has just been my saving grace. It has been so great. Has given us extra income and something that I love to do, and I feel like it's so family-oriented with all my kids. We all participate in sustainable living, and I don't know that we ever would have gotten there without that.
Okay. And somewhere along the line, you joined the insanity that's now called blogging. What got you into that?
Absolutely. Yes, I did.
Well, what got you started into that?
Well, I just wanted really a platform to sell my book, and I wanted people to be able to find it. So I really did it just to sell my products, but as I started doing it, I realized that I needed to connect with the people that were buying the products and see what they really wanted. And I'm in the process of writing another book, and I've got a possible TV show, don't know about that yet. And anyway, it's just a way to interact with people. people and to see what clicks with people and what doesn't, and to interact with different bloggers, you know, that are doing the same thing that I'm doing, and you learn so much that way. Blogs are crazy packed with information. So I just want to be one of those people that am able to give information that is not readily available.
Yeah, that's a big deal for a lot of us.
Yes.
All right, so we've got an introduction, and we've got your first question ever for the Rural Roundtable as well.
Yes, it is.
And the question was, if I'm remembering correctly, father and a son, first time ever rabbit hunting.
Yes.
Wife is not real thrilled about eating rabbits, so the husband's got to cook the first.
Yes, and that's what happens very often. And that's why I wrote these books for women. But they're for men, too. And actually, more than half, about half and half of my blog is made up of men because of the wild game. And I'm not sure that I've been able to turn a lot of women's heads with that, but that was my original goal. So, yes, rabbit. Okay. You know, I will make squirrel. We have made every kind of thing, I think, in this house because, you know, we have the rule, if you kill it, you eat it.
Yes.
So, I've learned how to do a lot of things. Now, rabbit is a really great meat. So, I don't hesitate when I'm making rabbit. Rabbit's fantastic, and especially if you raise it. But wild rabbit's great, too. They both, if you let them forage, that the flavor of rabbit is so incredible, and it's kind of like an elevated chicken that has a little bit more of a sweet taste, but it's different than the chicken you get at the store, just like your free-range chickens, just because of the connective tissue, and you have to deal with that. So, I can tell you a few things. Do you have any specific thing you want to know, or do you want me just to tell you all of the things I know about rabbit and what to do with it?
Just pick one or two things, because this guy, he has... I don't know how well he cooks. I don't know any of that. But
okay.
he wanted a recipe or two or an idea or two.
Okay.
Where it would encourage his wife to be a little more open-minded to wild game.
All right. One thing that, you know, wives are always looking for is ease and a fast cleanup. Now, I'm going to give you one of those recipes first, and then I'm going to give you my favorite.
Okay.
And so that one is, and see, if you don't know the age of the rabbit, if it's a young rabbit, then you can almost cook that any kind of way because the connective tissue is not going to be quite so difficult. But if it's an older rabbit, you would need to braise that, which is all that is cooking it in a liquid at a very low temperature for a very long time. So like at barely a simmer.
Yes.
But what I'm going to say here, the recipe that I'm thinking that would be great. Now, he went out in the woods, though, and got it wasn't a farm-raised rabbit,
no,
right?
It was not. It was a hunted rabbit.
Okay, then braising is going to be the best option. So I would take some garlic, some celery, some onions, and I would get those and some butter, and I would just put them in a Dutch oven, which is like one of my very, very favorite things to use, and I would just sweat those in that butter, and that means just getting it very, well, you can caramelize it, whatever, just put it over some heat until they're translucent and you can see through it, and then I would put chicken stock in it, and then I would put some peppercorns and some bay leaves, and you don't have to do any of that if you don't want to, some salt and pepper, and then I would put my rabbit, he needs to go ahead and skin the rabbit, and also, if possible, go ahead and get it cut into sections, you know, like your leg and your thigh and your breast meat and all that. Put it down into the braising liquid and let it go for on low and slow until it just starts falling apart. And at that point, you can serve it over rice. You can serve it in any way that you want to. You could get out of the braising liquid, and you can even put it in spaghettis. People make hamburgers out of rabbit. You can grind it and do hamburgers. And that might be an option, too, as long as the husband's willing to do all the grind of it so that she can just put the freezer, you know, directly. So I think the key is that a lot of people don't think that that's really an animal, and they buy it and eat it, and they think, you know, they're like, you know, oh, yeah, that's terrible and inhumane to hunt. They're eating meat. It's just really odd. But
yeah.
But anyway, that's one of the methods. You can also put it, like, in duck fat and, like, braise it like that, like, and it would be really, really super tender. And I do that with ducks, too. And then you can pull it apart and have, like, barbecue sandwiches with that.
Okay.
So that's real easy. All you're doing is just putting it in fat. You can also use vegetable oil. And you just put it in the oven at 225 degrees.
Okay.
And just let it go for, I mean, like, 6 hours.
Oh,
but you're
okay.
not doing anything. You're just, it's going in there at a very slow, low temperature, covered. And it'll come out and it'll look real blonde. But you can just put, you know, get it out of there, shred it up, and put, you know, white sauce, or regular, darker barbecue sauce, whatever you want to do, and have it in a hoagie bun. I mean, it's that simple. Now, my favorite way, I told you I would give you my favorite way, it's in my book called Recipes and Tips for Sustainable Living, and I believe it's on my website. I'm pretty sure that I put it on there.
Okay.
It is fried rabbit, and you take the bones out, you soak it in buttermilk overnight, and the acid in the buttermilk will help to tenderize the meat, and then when you get it out, you put salt and pepper on it, and you know, kind of drip. You don't get all of the buttermilk off of it, but you just kind of make sure it's not just, like, soaking wet when you put it in the flour. Then you're going to put it in some flour, and you're going to fry it, like, with oil about 3/4 inch up of a cast iron skillet. So you'll fry it in there until it reaches 160 degrees. That's the big thing, is to make sure that it's all the way cooked through. Put it on a cooling rack and let it sit there while you cook the rest of the rabbit. Then you make waffles, which I also have the recipe that's right under that. And so you make waffles, and then you have rabbit and waffles, or waffles and rabbit with sage. You can put I make sage butter, but you don't have to do that, you know, because that might be getting a little bit foodie-like. But you can do that and serve it with that with some maple syrup. It is amazing. So those, I have tips, I have all kinds of other stuff I can tell you, but that is the gist of how to cook a rabbit.
Well, now, I always did the buttermilk with the fried rabbit, too. Never
yes.
did do it with waffles. We always just did it with biscuits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, still really great. Yeah.
And then we always did rabbit dumplings.
Oh, yeah, that's really good, too. Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But
that's good stuff.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I hope that I think his name was Samuel T. was the guy who called or
okay,
emailed.
Great.
So I appreciate it. And folks, if you have any more questions on cooking, especially wild game, Stacey Lynn, you're willing to answer them, right?
I will be more than willing to answer them. And please come to gameandgarden.com. And if you're listening to the podcast, do send me a note that you heard me on it. And you can do that through the contact on gameandgarden.com. And check out my books and also have a line of products. And just check it all out. And follow me on Facebook. Sustainable Stacey is the link in the URL. And on Twitter, Stacey Lynn Harris is pretty much everywhere else. So, yeah, I'm so glad I got to talk to you today. And it's been great. I love the Rural Roundtable.
Well, I'm glad, and I'm glad to have you a part of it. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll just go from there.
All right. Thanks.
Our next question is for our homeschooling expert, Tiffany Davis. Tiffany Davis is with imperfectlyhappy.com. And the question is that a grandparent is wanting to be able to homeschool their granddaughter. Now, their granddaughter will not be of school age for a couple more years, so she's asking about how to do it, how to go about convincing her daughter that it's a good idea. So with that, we'll hear what Tiffany has to say.
Hello, this is Tiffany Davis from imperfectlyhappy.com. This is such a great question, and I commend you for your interest in homeschooling your granddaughter and starting your research early. And yes, in most states, a grandparent can homeschool their grandchildren if they're the legal guardian or they have permission from the parents to do so. It is important to check your state's laws for confirmation on that, and then also any other laws that govern your state's homeschool expectations. I recommend looking at Homeschool Legal Defense Association's website for information. That is hslda.org, and then look up your particular state. As far as talking to your daughter about homeschooling, I would say it's important to start with statistics. Look for things on how well homeschooled children are doing in educationally, like standardized tests, And then in the future, how many colleges are eager to accept them? And that's including Ivy League schools. If you think she's worried about socialization, I would suggest having a prepared list of homeschooling activities that are available in your area. Now, these can include anything like co-op learning groups, park or play days, theater groups, arts and crafts, or pretty much anything else that you can imagine. But don't discount things that aren't labeled homeschool, like Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and things that maybe your church offers. Remind her that a great part about homeschooling is that kids are not age segregated, and that they learn to communicate with people of all ages instead of just their peers. You should also address your concerns about sending your granddaughter to school and why you think that homeschooling would be such a wonderful experience. Lastly, you might want to consider asking for a trial period, say a semester or a year, and this will allow your granddaughter to see how she enjoys homeschooling and to let your daughter see how she's doing and if you really enjoy it as much as you're expecting to. Let me cap all of this with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. "The function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of true education." I believe that quote sums up the goals in most homeschools too. Best of luck to you in the future. I hope it all works out for you. Answering for the Rural Roundtable, this is Tiffany Davis with 3 homeschool graduates and 1 more to go. You can find me at imperfectlyhappy.com, and you can find my book, Homeschooling Fundamentals, on Amazon.com. Keep your homeschooling questions coming. I enjoy answering them.
Thanks, Tiffany, and that's just a really good answer. I know that in our area, in the state of Alabama, that grandparents are allowed to homeschool grandchildren with their parents' permission. And I also know that in our area, there are actually quite a few activities for homeschool children. And in all honesty, there's nothing that they'll be left out of, because self-directed learning and the internet has just opened up so many things. Now, you do have to make sure that you have grade points where you check to make sure that progress is being made. I do like the idea of a trial period. That way, you know, it's seen that to the parent that the grandparent is actually doing a good job. See, in our area, the AEA, the Alabama Educational Association, is one of the biggest unions in the whole state of Alabama, and they really, really, really fight hard against all homeschooling because it's taking money out of their pockets. I've heard more than a few teachers say that homeschooling is generally no schooling. Well, I've met enough homeschool kids to realize that that's not always the case. In fact, you know, unless the parents are just doing absolutely nothing, or the homeschool director's doing absolutely nothing, that's just simply not the case. So I really appreciate Tiffany's answer, and I think you'll get a lot out of it too. And for that lady who asked that question, congratulations on trying to take charge of your granddaughter's education. Our next question is actually on raising dairy animals on small acreage. Scott from North Country Farmer, which is our resident animal husbandry and dairy expert, will be giving that answer, and he does a really good job, and then I'll have a little bit more to say after he's done.
Hello, this is Scott Terry from NorthCountryFarmer.com, and our question today is there a dairy animal that I can raise sustainably on 2.5 acres? I really want to have some dairy animals. I have looked at miniature cattle, but I think our place is too small. Well, keeping a dairy animal sustainably on 2.5 acres will certainly be a challenge. Now, I'm not sure of your location or growing season, so some of this might be a little vague, but I'll try to answer your question as best I can. I graze Jersey cattle myself, and they're a little bit on the smaller side compared to other breeds of cattle. A mature Jersey cow is about 850 pounds, to give you a little bit of an idea, and for grazing purposes alone, just during the grazing season, you need to figure between 1 to 3 acres per animal just for grazing. Now, where I live, we have to dedicate about 3 acres per animal for grazing. And so for one cow in the area where I live, you're looking at 3 acres just during the 6 months that you can graze them. And so those figures aren't counting winter feed, which you're looking at a cow of that size lactating usually requires about 50-55 pounds of dry matter a day, and your average homestead animal is gonna get that dry matter intake through dry hay. And so you're looking at 50 pounds of hay a day per cow, and that's going to have to be produced somewhere. And so if when you say sustainably, you mean that you're going to be able to do this all off of your own land, then probably even an animal as small as a Jersey cow isn't going to work, because even if you live in the South where you have a longer season than I do, there are parts, times of the year where you're going to have to supplement feed. And so probably not feasible on a 2.5 acre homestead to be able to expect to provide hay and pasture for a cow. Now, miniature cattle, you mentioned, would require less, but not that much less. Even if you figured half, which I'd be surprised if it was that much less, but you're still probably pushing the envelope a little bit on 2.5 acres. Now, personally, I'm not a big fan of miniature cattle. One, because they're not very efficient. Two, we're dealing with some pretty small gene pools. It's hard to find any outcross genetics. They're, and depending upon what kind of miniature cattle you're looking at, there's a lot of health problems associated with them. But even the ones that aren't, Dexters and Caries, for example, I had a good friend that raised a Caries, and as he put it, they produced about as much as a well-bred Sonnen goat. And so my question has always been, why feed a cow when you could feed a goat? Because to be honest, you're not getting any kind of an advantage with miniature cattle, because when their production is about equal to that of a goat, they eat a tremendous amount more than a goat. And so for an acreage of that size, goats might be something that you could look at. But again, there's going to be times of the year when you're going to have to supplement goats as well. And goats are a different breed of cat. Goats are browsers, they're not grazers. So figuring out pasture requirements for goats is going to be a little different, because they like a little bit kind of pasture than cattle do. But even with well-managed pasture, you'll probably get more bang for your buck with goats, but you're still probably at some point going to have to supplement feed. Now, whether or not you can do that on 2.5 acres, I'm doubtful that you could. But this is kind of where the question hangs up on is to do it sustainably. And I might put forth the idea that whether you can do it completely sustainably on that property or not, maybe you should still have dairy animals. Because the benefits could far outweigh the fact that you may have to bring in some outside inputs to take care of them. You might be able to sell extra milk to your neighbors, and you might be able to use some of that money to go towards extra hay that you might need to feed. Now, manure. Manure is an asset. If you don't have a lot of livestock on your homestead, then the amount of nitrogen that you could get from a dairy cow or a couple of goats, if it's composted and taken care of properly, can be a great benefit to your gardens. And that's another thing. If you're looking at the manure aspect of it, manure on a very small homestead can either be a liability or an asset. If you just let it pile up and get out of hand, it's a liability. And the next thing you know, your 2.5 acres is covered with manure piles. But if you work out a plan and a system to compost that manure and do it efficiently so that it's not piling up and taking up huge amounts of space, then it's an asset. You could sell composted manure to your neighbors, although I would guess that you probably find plenty of uses for it on your own place. And the other reason that you might want to consider having dairy animals, even if you have to bring in some outside inputs, is that they lend stability to the homestead, and dairy animals tend to anchor you to the land. And without dairy animals, you can be a quote-unquote homesteader and be wanting to go back to the agrarian ways and lifestyle, but it's still pretty easy for you to get sucked into modern life, going here and there, taking off overnight trips, vacations, all those little things that really don't lend themselves to the homesteader's lifestyle in the long run. And I know a lot of people look at dairy animals anchoring you to the land as a liability, but I tend to think that it's a great blessing, and it really helps to foster a bond to your land and to the animals and to that way of life that no other enterprise on a homestead can do. Civilization, most civilized societies, what they have in common is dairy animals. But I think I've already gone over my allotted time here. So once again, this is Scott Terry, and from NorthCountryFarmer.com and BackwoodsResistance.com. And I'm answering for the Rural Roundtable, and I enjoy your questions, so feel free to send some more.
I think Scott is absolutely right in that dairy goats would be a much better option for a 2.5 acre plot. Even with the miniature cattle, you're still going to need more land than what you really have available. In addition, like you said, goats will be much more efficient, and their foraging tendencies are a little bit different. Now, I would suggest that you keep your herd small. For somebody who's looking at that, a lot of people don't realize that the average dairy goat produces anywhere from a half a gallon to a gallon and a half per day. Now, for our family, that would be way more than we would ever use. Now, I do realize that dairy goats do not, their milk is naturally homogenized. Now, what that means is that their butter fat doesn't separate the way dairy cattle's does. So you're not going to be able to make butter near as easily with goat's milk as you would be able to do so with cow's milk. But, you know, you can still make cheeses, you can still drink it. Now, a lot of people are real worried about a flavor difference between goat's milk and cow's milk. And there is a slight difference. It's not enough for most people to be able to notice. Now, here's the big thing. Even with dairy cattle, their milk will be, the flavor of the milk will be determined by what they graze on, what they forage on. The same thing is true with goats. If you have a lot of, like wild onions, for example, I have drank cow's milk where there was a lot of wild onions in the field, and just be honest, it wasn't very good. So you'll want to look at that as well. Another thing to consider is rotational grazing. Now, down here in Alabama, we have a much longer growing season than they do up in upstate New York, which is where Scott is. So that's one reason why he kind of hedged his bets on foraging abilities, because the person really didn't say where they were from. But rotational grazing, you could actually set it up as a wagon wheel. Now, what I mean by a wagon wheel is they said they were on 2.5 acres. So if they have two nannies, then they could actually set up like a goat shed in the center and have seven rotational pastures that split off from that main goat shed in the center. And every 2 days, they would just turn them loose in a different section of the pasture, and they would run it either in a clockwise or a counterclockwise, or really how, whatever fashion they wanted to. Now, what this would do is this would allow every plot of ground to rest for 14 days before you got back to it. So grasses would be able to grow and everything, and the manure and everything, which he mentioned, is a valuable asset. Another thing I want is, this is especially true here in the Southeast, actually most of the Eastern United States. Chinese privet is very prevalent, and goats absolutely love it. But privet is a neurotoxin. So if they eat too much of it, goats have been killed by eating too much privet. Now, I know folks that go, wow, they've eaten the whole thing down and it's never affected any of my goats. Yeah, I understand that, but it's because they've forage on so many other things. So you want to be mindful to make sure that your goats aren't focusing on a single dietary source. So this would be really good, and it's he did an excellent job on the question, and like you said, that he would love to answer more questions. All of the Rural Roundtable are eager to answer your questions. And I hope you learned something today, and I hope you enjoyed it. So, that was pretty cool. First ever full roundtable episode. Step by step, we're bringing rural back. Bye.